The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
Ah, so it is. So it is. Welcome. Welcome. Welcome to a Wednesday. I'm Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com on the Progressive Voices Network, streaming video on Periscope, on Twitch, on Facebook Live, counting the days. We got allegedly 8 days left, or seven days left, until my streaming suspension from YouTube is lifted. You want to take a bet? I'd lay $5 on the line that when the day comes, YouTube does not miraculously lift my suspension. Just because, you know, that's what I think. But I will see. Honestly, it is what it is. Damn it. So, do you know what today is? Today is October 7th. Yeah, October 7th, and that date may not mean much to you, but think back 4 years ago today. It was a big day in the 2016 presidential election sweepstakes. October 7th, 2016, it was just 2 days before the first scheduled debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. At around 3:30 Eastern that afternoon, a statement went out from the office of the Director of National Intelligence. At that time, it was James Clapper. And also, in conjunction with James Clapper and the DNI, from the Department of Homeland Security and its Secretary Jay Johnson. Remember, it was still the Obama administration. People were in charge who kind of, sort of knew what they were doing, kind of. Anyway, they sent out this statement in the form of a press release announcing that the Obama administration was finally accusing the Russian government of meddling in the election. This statement, blamed Russia for hacking the DNC and orchestrating the release of thousands of emails. Here's a quote from the release. Quote, the U.S. intelligence community is confident that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including from U.S. political organizations. These thefts and disclosures are intended to interfere with the U.S. election process. So again, that was the story that news organizations would run with. It stopped the presses, so to speak, for maybe a half hour, because it was just about 30 minutes later at around 4 p.m. Eastern on October 7th, 2016, that the Washington Post published a video. You know where I'm going with this, don't you? Hold on, I'm trying to get it all up so I can play it for you. Bear with me just a moment, because, you know, I am a one-woman show here, and I sometimes am a little mixed up. So that was the story. 30 minutes later, the Washington Post publishes this video that came to be known as the Access Hollywood tape. Oh, yeah. A recording of Donald Trump from some years earlier, I believe it was 2005, on a bus, on a hot mic, talking to Access Hollywood's Billy Bush about women in the crudest possible of terms. All right, here's what he said. Here we go. By the way, this video contains graphic language.
She's still very beautiful.
I moved on her, actually. You know, she was down at Palm Beach. I moved on her. And I failed. I'll admit it.
Whoa.
I did try and fuck her. She was married.
That's huge news there.
No, Nancy. Yeah. No, this was marriages.
And I got to give you audio. Hold on, everybody.
I took her out furniture shopping. She wanted to get some furniture. I said, I'll show you where they have some nice furniture. I took out furniture. I moved on her like a bitch.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get there. And she was married. And all of a sudden, I see her. She's now got the big phony tits and everything. She's totally changed
nice.
Her life.
She's your girl's hot as shit. In the purple.
Whoa.
Yes, Nadal has scored.
Whoa.
Oh, my man.
Wait, you got to look at me when
just
you get out of your
life. Sets this up.
That is very
will you give me the thumbs up?
Wow.
You are a piece.
You got to put the thumbs up. You got to get the thumbs up.
Can't be too happy. Can we get first?
Yeah, let me.
It's very funny.
So this is the edited tape. Right.
Oh, my God.
We don't get the whole thing, but we get all the good, juicy parts.
Maybe it's a different one.
Better not be the
publicist.
No, it's her.
Yeah, that's her, with the gold. I gotta use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the pussy.
Oh, please.
I can do anything.
Legs. All I can see is the legs.
No, it looks good.
Should I keep going? I mean, you know what's
going on.
Yeah. I think that's enough. Right? I mean, that's enough. You remember that quite clearly, I'm sure. I certainly do. That was 4 years ago today. And at that point, everyone thought, that's it. It's over. There's no way this cretin can recover from that insanity. But Trump did what he always does. He denied reality and he just kept going. But the day wasn't over yet. 30 minutes later, at about 4:30 Eastern, the third major story of the day broke when WikiLeaks began tweeting links to emails hacked from John Podesta's personal email account. John Podesta, of course, at the time, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. By the way, those releases, those emails for those WikiLeaks leaks kept coming almost every day through the final weeks of the election. Over 20,000 pages of emails. And again, over the course of the subsequent days, we're all thinking, okay, Trump is toast. Even some of the Republicans criticized him.
What you're seeing?
Oh, shoot. I'm playing the wrong thing. Hold on. I had my scary music. I thought I had my scary music up. Here we go. Some Republicans even criticized him. Yeah, but it didn't last long because Trump denies reality. He's a gaslighter. And the more when it was apparent that he was going to just deny reality and keep going, the idiots in the Republican Party got behind him, figuratively speaking. Unbelievable. So those three stories happened, right? 4 years ago today. And here's the thing. The first one, we heard nothing more about. The first one, which in the big scheme of things is probably the most important of the three. The fact that the Obama administration, its director of national intelligence, and the secretary of Homeland Security, both joining forces to say, we have a problem. Houston, there's a problem with our election security, and it's coming from Russia. And then the Washington Post, I'm sure, I don't know. I think that was probably scheduled to drop that afternoon. I don't think it had much to do with the fact that Jay Johnson and whatchamacallit, you know, that they sent out this statement. But the third release, the release by WikiLeaks, the beginning of the stream of John Podesta's private emails, make no mistake about it, that happened 30 minutes after the dropping of the Access Hollywood tape because Russia was coming to Donald Trump's rescue. They wanted, with John Podesta's emails, to knock the story of the Access Hollywood grab him by the pussy off the front pages. Problem is, sex sells. So while it didn't, the Podesta release, the WikiLeaks leaks didn't have their intended effect, it did have the effect of muting that first story, which should have been the big news of the day. And in fact, is what our guest today is going to talk with us about. His name is David Shimer, maybe Shimmer, but I think it's Shimer because there's one M. And the book is called Rigged, America, Russia, and 100 Years of Covert Electoral Interference. So what happened in 2016 and continues today is nothing new. Nothing new at all. All right, we got a lot of stuff to get through today, a lot of news to deal with, but let's do a funny, because I haven't in the last few days. And this one was just shared with me by our friend, Environmental Coffee House is her name in most of our chat rooms. I know that Sandy's name, Sandy Blue Ocean in some. She does an Environmental Coffee House show on YouTube every day dealing with our climate crisis. You should check her out. She's very good. Anyway, she sent this song to me on Twitter saying, I love these two. And I just opened it literally 5 minutes before I hit the air, because I was thinking she was retweeting the video of Mandy Patinkin and his wife that I played yesterday, that, by the way, got my whole video when I uploaded it to YouTube, which I have to do now after the fact because I'm banned from streaming for another week. Warner Music Group blocked the video, I think, because of the song, the ominous music playing in the background underneath Mandy Patinkin and his wife, Catherine. Unbelievable. There's something that needs to be done about this. Not today and not by me, but something needs to be done. Anyway, I digress. This is, it's a Tom Lehrer parody. So they're parodying a political satirist in song. Anyway, their names are Sandy and Richard Riccardi. And this one's called Trump Got It From Hope. Take it away, Sandy and Richard.
They love their friends invincibly. They're just as close as they can be. And just because they really care, whatever they got, they share.
The sound on this is horrible.
Trump,
sorry about that.
Hicks, he got it from Bill. We all agree it must have been Ron Johnson who made a bill. Now he got it from Haley, who got it from Christie. And everybody knows that Tom Tillis got it from Mike Lee. Then Kellyanne Conway, she gave it to her kid, who tipped off out a skating expo in her little bid. Gilbert and Nicholas Luna, and since you dared to ask, we all are wishing Mitch would just forget to wear his mask. Steve Miller's not right. He's been dead inside all his life. Ivanka doesn't have it, and that's really puzzling. She really loves her dad.
Oh, they're awesome. It's based on Tom Lehrer's I Got It From Agnes. And, oh, and it was, yeah, what are their names again? Sandy and Richard Riccardi. Not to be confused with Ricky Ricardo, although I'm dating myself. Anyway, funny stuff. I wish the audio was better, but hey, I'm no stranger to audio problems, am I? All right, we'll take a quick time out so Progressive Voices can get some business in. And oh my God, I won't do what I did yesterday. I so screwed up yesterday. I completely forgot to bring Progressive Voices back from the break. I apologize for that. I will not make that same mistake again today. I promise. Okay, so I believe they are now in a break, and I'll have to remember at the end of this break, I think, to bring them back. In the meantime, here we are. There's so much going on. And it, as we get closer to the election, we're now, we're 3 weeks out. Is that it? Hold on. Let me look at the calendar. It's 4 weeks out, 4 weeks from yesterday. Sorry, I was never good in math. Just, you know, making excuses. Anyway, there are so many great ads, promos, PSAs, I guess is what they really are, being released each day. So let me share the latest, or what, not even the latest, Midas Touch. Our friends, the Marcellus brothers, Midas Touch has been releasing just one after the next after the next. It's hard to keep up with them. But here's one just released in recent days that touches on Donald Trump's malady. And I'm not talking about the COVID. I'm talking about his other medical condition. Take it away, Midas Bros.
He knows the system better than me.
Does DJT have NPD?
Can you handle it? I don't think so.
Some of the best minds in psychiatry have claimed publicly that President Donald J. Trump suffers from narcissistic personality disorder.
I'm the best in business. I'm sexually the best.
They're talking about penis sizes.
No empathy. Everything has to refer to me.
He's paranoid.
But why trust the experts when you can examine him yourself? According to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, those with narcissistic personality disorder exhibit the following traits: an exaggerated sense of self-importance.
The one that matters is me.
A preoccupation with fantasies of unlimited success.
I've been very successful. Everybody loves me.
Power.
I have the right to do whatever I want as president.
Brilliance.
Putin did call me a genius.
Beauty or ideal love.
And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the...
The belief that they are special.
I am the chosen one.
And should associate with only other high-status people.
This has been in particular a great friendship.
Those with NPD require excessive admiration.
It was the biggest standing ovation since Peyton Manning won the Super Bowl.
Are interpersonally exploitative.
I love Mexican people. I've had thousands of Mexicans working for me.
They show contemptuous behaviors.
I don't know what I said.
Have a sense of entitlement.
I'm really rich.
And lack empathy.
1,000 Americans are dying a day.
It is what it is.
So you tell me, do you think DJT has NPD?
Ooh, Trump doesn't care about America.
Up all the fucks I have to give. I love my mama and my daddy. I love my wife and my son. I love picking on this old guitar. But I fucking hate Donald Trump. Yeah, I love the U.S. Constitution. But I fucking hate
Nicole Sandler's show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
All right, we are back. I got some news coming up, but before we get to it, I want to show you a picture. If you're watching on one of the video streams, you will see this. Here's just a screenshot of the set for tonight. This, I don't know if you can see, I'm circling. Can you see it? No, you can't. Damn it. This shows the plexiglass that is allegedly going to protect Kamala Harris from a probably infected Mike Pence. There are two little slivers of plastic that stand to the left of one and to the right of the other. Let me just tell you something. That's not going to do jack shit. I hope Mike Pence is really being tested. Before the debate last week, the first presidential debate, Donald Trump and his entourage arrived late too late to get tested, as every person was supposed to be before they walked into that room. And so they took their word for it. They took them on the honor system that they were COVID-free, Trump and his cronies. There is no honor in Trump land. Just like there's no crying in baseball, there is no honor in this administration, period. And Donald Trump was likely infected when he took to that stage. But we don't know for sure because they will not say when Donald Trump had his last negative test. It is a comedy of errors, except there's nothing funny here. I read the news today, oh boy. All right, so here's a little bit of what's going on in the news until we bring our guest on. A few things happened. I told you about that thing. A 3-judge panel in New York's Second Circuit Court of Appeals today rejected arguments from Donald Trump's legal team that the subpoena issued to Trump's accounting firm at the request of Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance was too broad and that the subpoena amounted to retaliation for the refusal of Trump's businesses to cooperate with Vance's office. So basically, this is the final appeals court. This is what it was sent down from the Supreme Court back to the lower courts to figure it out. The lower courts all upheld the previous rulings that Trump appealed. Now, either he goes back to the Supreme Court, who could choose not even to hear it again, or it goes to the Supreme Court. Either way, Cy Vance's office probably won't get Trump's tax returns until after the election. However, we already have them, thanks to the New York Times. Just work off of those, right? Yeah. Okay, in other news, yesterday was just another clusterfuck of a day in the Trump administration. It could be the steroids speaking or just Donald Trump's typical reckless, uninformed, and irresponsible behavior that prompted the coronavirus-infected president to tweet yesterday afternoon that he had ordered all negotiations on a new COVID relief package stopped immediately. Seriously. I get the feeling, despite his fiery talk, that Donald Trump doesn't want to win. Here's what he tweeted, some of what he tweeted. Nancy Pelosi is asking for $2.4 trillion to bail out poorly run, high-crime Democrat states, money that is in no way related to COVID-19. I think I sound a little more like Randy Rhoads than I do Donald Trump in that voice. Anyway, he said, we made a very generous offer of $1.6 trillion. And as usual, she's not negotiating in good faith. I am rejecting their request and looking to the future of our country. And he goes on and on and on. Then he says, I've instructed my representatives to stop negotiating until after the election when, immediately after I win, we will pass a major stimulus bill that focuses on hardworking Americans and small business. So what is he holding America hostage? It's the beginning of a new month. Actually, we're a week into it now. People are not only not working, many are now getting evicted because they don't have a job. They don't have income. They're still isolating at home. And, well, here we are. And then he says, I have asked Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to delay, but not to delay, but to instead focus full time on approving my outstanding nominee to the United States Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett. Ugh. Then he said, our economy is doing well. No, it isn't. The stock market is at record levels. No, it isn't. Jobs and unemployment also coming back in record numbers. No, they're not. And then he says, we're leading the world in economic recovery and the best is yet to come. Sorry, I did have a recording of her saying it, but, you know, I thought I'd go with the moment. Oh, God. Well, his announcement yesterday sent stocks plunging. The Dow had been up over 200 points, but after Trump's idiotic tweet, it closed down almost 400 points, and then he began backtracking on Twitter. He responded to a CNBC tweet that said, breaking, Fed Chair Powell calls for more help from Congress, says there's a low risk of overdoing it. And Donald Trump retweeted it with a one-word comment, true. What? That goes completely against what he had said hours before when he told Mitch McConnell and everyone else to stop negotiating with the Dems. The man is demented. And then it kept going. It went on for hours through the night. And you know, who knows where we are today? Donald Trump negotiates with himself, and he's a really shitty negotiator. In other news, members of Donald Trump's inner circle continue testing positive for the COVID. And the latest one, you know, I had read something yesterday earlier in the day. I saw a tweet, a lone random tweet that said Stephen Miller tested positive. And I was like, oh my God. And I went looking for corroborating evidence because, unlike some other people, I don't repeat information until it's corroborated, until I know it's true. So I saw one lone person on Twitter say Stephen Miller is COVID positive. But I didn't say anything while Laffy was on the air, and believe me, I was dying to. But I didn't have confirmation until last night. And then the news broke. Stephen Miller is the latest White House official to test positive for coronavirus. His wife, Katie Miller, Katie, whatever her last name is, I don't know if she took his, is Vice President Mike Pence's communications director. Now, she tested positive in May. Pence tested negative, sorry, yesterday, ahead of tonight's debate. But I don't trust it, and I don't trust him. I don't trust any of them. And the White House, meanwhile, after its super spreader event, said it has completed, quote, all contact tracing for positive COVID-19 cases among its ranks. Again, that's not true. The CDC announced that the White House had refused its offer to help with contact tracing. And some of those infected and their family members have said they've not heard one word from anyone connected to the administration about the spread of the virus. They're done with contact tracing because they're not doing any contact tracing. It truly is just astounding. I would say I'm dumbfounded. Maybe I'm smart-founded. And finally, another day, another blockbuster news story about the Trump administration, this time from the New York Times, dealing with their heinous family separation policy. The New York Times is now reporting that when federal attorneys first expressed concern about the welfare of the children they were separating from their parents and Trump's policies around immigration, that then Attorney General Jeff Sessions said he wasn't interested in their objections. The report, which you can read at the New York Times, includes shorthand notes from a prosecutor who was on a phone call with Sessions. And the notes read, quote, "We need to take away children. If care about kids, don't bring them in. Won't give amnesty to people with kids." The report also found that Sessions, Rod Rosenstein, and other top Department of Justice officials were a, quote, driving force behind the family separation policy. And Rosenstein, who we're learning more and more not very good things about each day, he was the deputy attorney general at the time, said a week later that children of all ages should be prosecuted. And that's a direct quote. You know, this administration does so much that's wrong, that's evil, that's just plain fucked up, that new shit replaces the old. So we're not even talking about these family separations anymore, but we damn well should be. There's so much. And I hope there's some kind of commission after this criminal is evacuated from the Oval Office, that they investigate every one of these crimes he's committed. Another thing, you know, when Harry Shearer was on Monday, he's in New Orleans. He and his wife Judith live there part of the time. And I mentioned in an offhanded way that the crazy number of storms that have hit the Gulf Coast. And here we are again. Hurricane season doesn't even end until November 30th. But the Gulf Coast has been taking a beating. And now Hurricane Delta is threatening. The storm intensified yesterday. Its tropical storm force winds of 40 miles per hour grew to 145 miles per hour, a Cat 4 storm in just 36 hours. That transformation makes it the fastest Atlantic hurricane growth on record. This is scary stuff. I hope our friends on the Gulf Coast are staying safe. And, you know, here in South Florida, I'm just thankful that these storms are going a little bit to the west and not hitting us because, you know, they very well could have. So anyway, that's where we are. There's more. For instance, the top U.S. generals are quarantining now, in line with the rest of the Trump administration, who's all infected. But I want to, our guest, I see, has entered the room. So I want to take you back to where we began. And that was the fact that 4 years ago today, major news broke, or let me say it again, what should have been major news broke when our director of national intelligence and the Secretary of Homeland Security released a statement saying that Russia has been interfering with the U.S. elections. And I bring that up again because our guest today, let me welcome him back to welcome to the show in the first place, David Shimer? How do I pronounce your name?
It's Shimer.
Shimer, David Shimer, who is the author of this brand new book, Rigged: America, Russia, and 100 Years of Covert Electoral Interference. So, David, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome to the show. And I didn't realize when I booked you for today, although I'd like to take credit for it, it's just a coincidence, that it was 4 years ago today that the Obama administration officially admitted that Russia was interfering in the elections. I'm sure you're well aware of the date and the history behind it.
Yeah, no, I think that was one of the more eventful and surreal days of this whole story and this ongoing story of Russian interference in our elections.
Absolutely. In fact, I have the page flagged where you say Johnson, Jay Johnson and Clapper released their statement at 3 p.m. anticipating that it would receive wall-to-wall coverage. But just after 4 p.m., The Washington Post published a recording from 2005 of Trump boasting to Billy Bush of Access Hollywood that he would grab women, quote, by the pussy. Then at 4:32 p.m., WikiLeaks began uploading the personal emails of Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta. And so what I've talked about before you joined us, David, is the first story, everyone thought that was going to be the blockbuster of the day, but then Access Hollywood happened, and then the WikiLeaks Podesta emails happened. And the mention, the stories that should have been everywhere about the Russian interference in the election pretty much fell off the face of the earth, right? It got next to no coverage.
Yeah, and I think the statement ended up being buried. I think President Obama's advisors, as they say in my book, would be the first ones to lament that the story got buried. And I think all in all, in that period, in the summer and fall of 2016, unlike I hope today, I think this threat, this idea of a foreign adversary interfering in our elections just seemed so new and out of nowhere that it was very difficult for the electorate to wrap its head around in real time. And that's part of why I wrote this book, which seeks to actually show that 2016 was only the latest chapter in a very old history of covert operations to interfere in elections, and that so long as we recognize that and recognize that we are continually grappling with this threat, then we can actually get ahead in seeking to defend against it.
Right. So you're saying, well, we thought this was sort of a novel idea back in 2016. Really? The Russians interfering in our elections, that actually this has been going on for the better part of a century.
So that's exactly right. What I do in my book is restore history to the subject of covert electoral interference, because I think that's so important. Because I think when something's treated as unprecedented, it makes it so people are easily able to spread lies about something, manipulate understandings of something. But when you restore context and restore history, it all really starts to make sense. So in this book, I show how the Soviet Union interfered in elections all over the world between the First and Second World Wars, how the CIA and the KGB went toe-to-toe in elections on a global basis during the Cold War, how Russia is again interfering in elections aggressively and frequently around the globe in the 21st century, and only then do I examine the 2016 election and that story based on my interviews with President Obama's inner circle to really get at the heart of this issue, which is, what did Russia do? Why was it so difficult to defend against that operation in real time? And what should we be learning and doing now in order to make sure that we secure our elections as well as we possibly can moving forward?
Right. So the book, you don't even get into 2016 until chapters 9 through 13. The whole first part is the earlier history, but 2016 ushered in kind of a new era where the covert activities changed, mostly because of the advances in technology and the internet.
That's exactly right, because in the Cold War, you know, I interviewed for about half a day a former KGB general for the book, and he told me about his efforts to interfere in U.S. elections during the Cold War in 60 and 68 to hurt Richard Nixon, 76 and 84 to hurt Ronald Reagan. But those efforts were very limited because without that digital connectivity, the ability of the Soviets to interfere in our elections at scale was sorely lacking. That was no longer the case in 2016. As a result of both the digitization of our information environment and our infrastructure, as well as the deep polarization of our society that made us so unable to respond in a unified way against this threat to our national sovereignty, it was really open season and an enormous opportunity for Russia to seek to sabotage our election and sow discord within our discourse.
David Scheimer is with us. His new book is called Rigged, and it details the history of Russian influence in our election. Donald Trump, you know, he's the master of gaslighting, and he's now these days he's saying, well, you know, we don't know that it's Russia. It could be China, or it could be Iran. Are other countries practicing this type of election interference around the world?
No. So this is primarily a story of Soviet and now Russian electoral interference. And secondarily, it's a story of American interference during the Cold War and in some cases immediately thereafter. But this tradition here is a tradition of Moscow's attempts to at first advance leftist or communist candidates during the 20th century. And now Putin is executing a global strategy to support authoritarian minded and divisive candidates around the world. You know, I sat down with the president of Montenegro, whom Russian intelligence tried to assassinate. I talked with the former president of Colombia, whose social media environment he received reports of being under siege. So this is a global problem as democratic leaders struggle to defend their own elections, coupled with America's inability not only to defend its elections, but also to help its allies do the same. So stack that up against China or Iran, who A, don't have a history of engaging in this type of behavior, and B, don't have a global reason to do so on a global strategic basis. So maybe moving forward, China or Iran will interfere in a targeted manner in specific elections, as we've seen evidence of in places like Taiwan or Australia. But to therefore say that you expect or anyone expects Iran to interfere in dozens of elections at any one time, I don't think that would make any sense for Iranian foreign policy, nor do I think it would align with the history of Iranian intelligence.
Gotcha. And that's what I thought. And it's another example, I guess, of Trump and his administration just making shit up, because that's what they do. All right, so I'm going through the book Rigged, and I'm trying to get a handle on this. So going back to 2016, Barack Obama really screwed up here, didn't he? I mean, you wrote that Obama had settled for a policy of managed interference, working to contain but not stop Russia's operation. Rather than impose costs on Putin in real time, he had focused on preventing one form of electoral interference, changing actual votes, while neglecting another, changing minds. And at one point you do say that this is the two ways that they interfere, by screwing with the votes themselves or screwing with people's minds. So you're saying Obama just dealt with the, you know, changing actual votes, but neglected the changing minds part. And that's where they were very successful.
So that is the distinction that's essential to understanding President Obama's response to Russia's operation in real time. As you said, there are always across history only two ways to interfere in an election: by manipulating public opinion or by manipulating actual systems or, you know, stuffing ballot boxes, hacking into voting systems. And in 2016, Russia ran both of those plays at once. They both were seeking to manipulate public opinion by stealing and releasing emails, which the Obama team had a very good understanding of at the time, and by spreading propaganda across social media, which the Obama team had a more limited understanding of at the time. In conjunction with that, Russian military intelligence was probing, penetrating, and scanning election systems across the country, giving them the capability, as John Brennan says in the book, to alter the voter data and even vote tallies of U.S. citizens. And so the possibility that Russia could or would seek to sabotage our election infrastructure, sow chaos on election day, captivated the White House, was the predominant focus of the White House, in the words of President Obama's chief advisors, to make sure that election day unfolded in a stable manner. And so each move the president made in the summer and fall was meant to deter or prepare for such an attack, all the way to election day itself, when, as I reveal in the book, the White House and DHS were actually running secret crisis teams bracing for Russia to seek to affect our election systems. That attack never came. It never manifested itself. But all the while, tens of millions of Americans had been reached by Russian propaganda through those earlier two vectors I mentioned, the social media manipulation and the email dumps.
Right. And you say Obama had prioritized protecting the ballot box from direct manipulation, but at a cost. Russia had brazenly manipulated voters' minds. And here we go again. The problem is, we know what happened on Election Day 2016. Thank you, Electoral College. Donald Trump pulls out a win, a Hail Mary win, losing the popular vote by almost 3 million votes, but small enough margins in some of those swing states to pull out an Electoral College win. And from the get-go, he denies that Putin did anything wrong. And for the last almost 4 years, we have watched him at every turn refuse to hold Putin and Russia to account. Do you go into that at all? Do you deal with why or how he's compromised? Because obviously he has to be.
So I dive into the dynamic of Trump and Putin in the aftermath of Russia's operation in the 13th chapter of my book. And as for that question, I think I have a couple of details to offer. The first is, I did interview a former KGB general, as I mentioned, who said that he'd learned from his colleagues in the late 80s that they had learned things about Donald Trump during his visit to Moscow, whatever that means. But it's also important to say that that general lacked direct evidence of this. It was just his memory. The second key point here is that something that's a pattern across history is that when leaders do not condemn foreign interference on their behalf, they typically become psychologically indebted to those foreign actors, and they become insecure about their own electoral legitimacy. And when we've seen Donald Trump, you know, say it didn't change any votes or Russia didn't interfere, that in some ways is signaling that he's showing that same degree of insecurity that so many leaders across the world have shown when foreigners have helped them get elected and they didn't say no. Because prior to Trump, other U.S. politicians such as Hubert Humphrey and Adlai Stevenson had been approached by the Soviet Union with offers to help them. And Stevenson more or less said, you know, get the hell away from me. That was the tradition before this, whereas now it's been sort of a let's just deny what's going on and expect to benefit from it anyway, as the Mueller report concluded. And the last thing I'll say on that point is I did interview several Trump senior advisors who have left the administration, several of whom said that they worry that the president wants Russia to help him get reelected. One of whom says that he came to fear inside the White House that Donald Trump was actually doing Russia's bidding. Although, again, no evidence other than his posture and policymaking toward Russia. So I think there are open questions here. And I think those questions are on the minds of some of the people who are serving in the government.
You know, Julian Assange is currently still in the middle of his extradition hearings. Donald Trump, throughout this whole episode, would constantly say things like, I love WikiLeaks, and talk about, you know, the release he had, obviously, information. Now more and more is coming out that it seems that Roger Stone was the conduit to WikiLeaks. Do you believe that the Russian government was involved in this, too? The third of the three stories that came out 4 years ago on this day Do you think there was a connection?
I wouldn't speculate. I mean, we know that WikiLeaks was a front for Russian intelligence. We know that Russia provided WikiLeaks with the information that it then released, the emails it then released. Whether the timing or the exact tactical approach of that apparatus, I don't know. But what I would also say, and something that I really emphasize in my book, is that on the one hand, these questions do matter because we need to know who in our government, if anyone, is serving the interests of anything but the United States.
Sure.
But equally important to that, I think these questions in some ways attract so much limelight, so much news coverage that they pull people away from the issue at the core here, which was Russia's operation to interfere in our election. The email dumps, the social media manipulation, and the exposure and penetrations of our voting systems. And so the other problem, too, with that question of coordination is it makes things feel so partisan, where if you think there's something there, typically it seems like you're a Democrat. If you think it's all a hoax, then it seems like you're a Republican. But where we should be and where we should be talking about as a nation is the fact that Democrats or Republicans, this is an affront to our sovereignty.
Yeah.
Russia is trying to choose our leaders for us to sabotage our democratic processes and to undermine the viability of the democratic model as a legitimate form of governance. And that should alarm all Americans, regardless of their party loyalties.
Without a doubt. So, we've looked at what's happened, what happened in 2016, which we're told by this administration's intelligence agencies, the community, that it's still happening from Chris Wray to on down, even, what's his name? Ratcliffe. I mean, the people who are the most partisan, most unqualified for their positions in the intelligence agencies in this administration are still saying, Russia is still interfering, still trying to, but Trump will not go there. He will not admit it. So do you feel safe? Are we protected? Do you think that that Russia is going to have a hand in what happens on November 3rd?
So I would say it's a fact at this point that Russia is very actively interfering in this election. Chris Wray, the FBI director, has said so under oath. We've seen Facebook and Twitter take down covert networks of Russian accounts. We've seen Microsoft reveal that Russian intelligence is targeting the personal accounts of hundreds of American political figures, presumably to steal and then potentially release data. And we've seen reports from our government that Russia is amplifying narratives such as voter fraud without any sort of factual basis or about the mental health of Donald Trump's opponent, Joe Biden. So we've seen early signs of Russia's operation. Typically, these things don't come into fuller view until months, if not years after, because they're definitionally supposed to be covert. But I would say that on the one hand, I am worried because not only as a result of the current president who hasn't condemned or sought to deter Russian interference, but also because of the coronavirus, which is sowed so much doubt about the stability of our voting process that it presents fertile ground for Russian sabotage to make Americans believe that our process of succession isn't working. But on the other hand, I wouldn't say that I think democracy is doomed. I would say that many countries, many democracies have had their elections manipulated by foreign actors. Most of those democracies remain democracies today. What this necessitates is engagement by citizens, education of citizens about fact-based, reliable information, how to function in a digital democracy, an effort to renew ourselves at home and to defend ourselves abroad, and also just clear-eyed engagement with our electoral processes, voting, staying calm, and waiting to see the results. I think we can do this as a nation, and I think we will, but I think we also just have to recognize that there are adversaries out there who would prefer that we not be functioning as a democracy that can serve as a model not only for our own people, but for the world.
You said a whole lot there, David Chimer. And let me ask you, I mean, you're the historian, you're the journalist and the author. Russia is not having an easy time with COVID either, right? I mean, I know they're not having an easy time. It's spreading there similarly to how it is here. Is that having an effect on their so-called intelligence? Is that infringing on their ability to spy on us or to try to interfere in our elections, or is not even a concern?
So I don't know the impact it will have on the ability of Putin's regime to make decisions. I mean, very interestingly, Putin as has been publicly reported, is very aggressively isolating himself, unlike our president, in making sure that he does not catch this disease. Whether that will affect his ability to coordinate with his intelligence chiefs and authorize these types of operations, I don't know. I think if he wanted to do it, just my analysis of it, I think he would still be able to function as the head of the Russian state in seeking to oversee such an operation. How that actually plays out over the next 4 to 5 weeks remains to be seen, because the question on my mind is not only whether Russia will seek to manipulate public opinion before Election Day, but also whether Russia will seek to affect our voting process on Election Day and seek to sow doubt about its legitimacy in the immediate days after Election Day, when people might be wondering when the votes will really be tallied, whether the vote count can really be trusted. And remember, Russia's ultimate goal here is to tear down American democracy, to degrade, disrupt, and discredit our democratic system. And so even if Trump were to lose, if Russia could help make it so many millions of Americans don't believe he really lost, that's still a win in Russia's playbook.
But even if he wins, I would submit that Donald Trump himself is a threat to the American version of democracy, because what he aspires to be is a dictator, is a Vladimir Putin, is a Milosevic, is a Erdogan. Those are the people he looks up to and reveres, while our, you know, democratic allies he's dissing and putting distance between us. I think he's a greater threat to the democracy than some Russian counterintelligence. Maybe I'm naive. Am I?
Well, I think that on the subject of Russian interference and our democracy, there are just a few things very specifically that I do wish Donald Trump would do differently. I do wish that Donald Trump would not say the threat of foreign electoral interference is a hoax, because that leads many millions of Americans to believe that's true. It generates this type of debate over whether a threat exists rather than how to address that threat, which is where we should be. I also think alleging that an election is rigged serves to undermine public confidence in our voting processes, in the legitimacy of the outcome of our process of succession, which really gets at the heart of our democracy, because a democracy functions so long as it has a process of succession. That provides for future, it provides for order, it provides for progress. And so I think any American leader who was seeking to shore up American democracy would be doing everything they could to make sure that we could hold a stable, reliable, trustworthy election this fall or this November. And unfortunately, I think that has not been the message coming out of the current administration.
Not at all. And so, I mean, I guess that this is not the time to place blame. There's plenty of blame to go around. But I still can't help going back to the Obama administration. And as you said, they were more concerned with keeping the voting machines safe from manipulation in that way. We do know that I'm in Florida, and at least a few counties in Florida were hacked into, a few other states. But for the most part, is it more difficult for them to get at our internal voting infrastructure because we don't have one uniform system throughout the country? We basically have 50 separate voting election systems.
So that's what many of the officials who I interviewed for my book emphasized. I interviewed in total more than 130 people, actually, including 8 former CIA directors and various DHS officials, DNIs, those sorts of folks. And what they said is the decentralized nature of our election administration provides for, you know, benefits and downsides, as any system would. The benefit being that it would be almost impossible to manipulate an American election directly at scale because of that huge diversity among the many, many jurisdictions that we operate at, the not only state but also county level. Mm-hmm. I would say that a weakness of that, as Jay Johnson, the former Homeland Security Secretary, put it to me, is that we're only as strong as our weakest link. And so if there's one state that is not taking sufficient cybersecurity measures, that makes it so that while a foreign actor couldn't manipulate results or cause chaos in every state, they could still cause chaos at, let's say, a few select polling places, which would serve not to change the outcome of the election, but just to sow confusion as voting's unfolding and make citizens wonder whether the result of the election can really be trusted, which again was the predominant concern in the crisis planning of the Obama team 4 years ago.
Right. And that seems to be Donald Trump's MO. That's the way he's doing it. He wants people to be scared and not vote. His whole call for poll watchers is absurd because I've been a poll watcher. You don't just show up and say, we're here to watch the polls. You have to register in advance. You have to be trained. There are limits. Most polling places allow one per party. And so he is, you know, ratcheting things up to instill chaos on election day. I mean, it's what I see. So I see Donald Trump really trying to interfere with our election, not so much foreign elections. But you also do point out that the United States historically has not been guilt-free in this process, that as much as Russia, Moscow, tried to interfere with our elections for a century, you say since 1991, beginning with the end of World War One, I mean 1919, sorry, that American operations to interfere in elections also happened. Are we still doing anything like that, or do we know?
So that's historically true, and that's spelled out in my book, where after the Soviet Union aggressively interfered in Eastern European elections between 45 and 47 in the preceding century, Harry Truman, the U.S. president, decided to respond to Soviet interference with American electoral interference, and he authorized the CIA formally to engage in covert action for the first time with the express purpose of interfering in an election. So the starting point of CIA covert action was actually electoral interference, wow, motivated by the idea that supporting a centrist party in Italy, in this case, would help to defend Italian democracy in the long term by preventing communists from taking power there and disbanding their democratic system as it happened across Eastern Europe. That was the logic, at least. How that played out in practice varied tremendously. But I would say after the Cold War, America moved away from this practice. I interviewed Bill Clinton, and he did acknowledge that he authorized the CIA to interfere in Serbia's election in 2000 to work against the tyrant Slobodan Milosevic. But since then, this has become, and by then, this had become the exception rather than the rule for various reasons that I'd be able to, that I'd be happy to discuss. And moving forward, I think this shouldn't just be the exception. I think this should be banned. I think that it is in America's interest and aligns with America's values to ban the practice of covert electoral interference, because at a time where we're so exposed, at a time where we're seeking to lead or should be seeking to lead a coalition against this practice, and we're seeking to deter Russia from engaging in it, the last thing we should be doing is getting down in the mud and imitating Russia's behavior, because even if that brings short-term benefits, the long-term costs to the legitimacy of our leadership, to the reputation of the democratic model, make this too unacceptable to bear as a policy option. So therefore, we might as well say we're not doing it, because something I found is that abroad, you know, many foreign officials remember that the U.S. has a history of doing this.
Wow.
And they say to me, you know, it's Russia, it's America, it's all the same story. And I think it's time for us to chart a new path and make it very clear that we've been doing so and we're going to continue doing so.
Wow. But you point out a distinction that jumped out at me here. Let me just share a paragraph. You wrote, Putin and his predecessors have long believed they could use covert electoral interference to weaken foreign democracies, while American presidents, sometimes wrong, have long believed they could use covert electoral interference to strengthen foreign democracies. Covert electoral interference is a more tense policy option for Washington, which has purported to manipulate democracies in order to solidify those democracies, than for Moscow, which has manipulated democracies in order to tear them apart. But it doesn't really matter what your motivation is if you're still doing something that's inherently wrong. Right.
As a historian, I'm most interested in explaining what America did, what the Soviet Union did, why both of their leaders authorized these operations. And then I want readers, I hope they will ask, was it right or wrong of Harry Truman to make this decision in 48? Was it right or wrong of future presidents to have made similar decisions? What should American policymaking be now? I think it's not accurate to say that there is an equivalency completely between American and Soviet interference here because of the distinction that you just mapped out. But I think it's also true that both America and the Soviet Union sought to support the candidates they liked and hurt the ones they didn't. The systemic objectives might have differed, but the methods of supporting one candidate over another were very much the same. And so I come out looking forward in believing that to engage in this practice is a 20th century solution to a 21st century threat landscape. But some people disagree. As stated in the conclusion of my book, folks like Harry Reid and Leon Panetta think that we should potentially get back in the game,
wow.
that America should consider interfering covertly in elections to counter Russia. And so while that's a debate that won't unfold in the public, I think it is one that is worth bearing in mind as we engage in this new competition with Russia, where its intelligence services are seeking to manipulate democratic elections and tear down democratic systems on a global scale.
Wow. So there's so many questions as to what you can believe, what is real, what isn't. And it's all coming to fore, you know, 4 weeks from yesterday. The book is called Rigged: America, Russia, and 100 Years of Covert Electoral Interference. David Scheimer, thank you so much for joining us today. It's fascinating. I hope people check it out, because the more we know, the better it is for all of us, I think. Anyway, thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. All right. And with that, we are we're done for the day. So we'll be back tomorrow with Howie Klein and do it all over again. Stay safe. Watch the debate tonight. See you tomorrow. Mm-hmm.